I want to talk to you today about what is without doubt the greatest technological invention from the ancient world, and in the words that of a famous writer that I will repeat at the end of this lecture, one of the greatest technological inventions ever made in the history of humankind. It's a truly remarkable device. So, I'm going to start off by talking about sponge divers. Sponges are an animal, and they are a multi-celled animal found at the bottom of the sea, almost always in salt water, and they're stuck to rocks. They do not grow on the shelves of Pick and Pay in little plastic baggies. That's just for the younger people here. There are about 5 to 10,000 different species of sponge. Most of them live in their entire lives only on the rock, but there are a few species that can move, and they move at this incredibly rapid rate that makes a snail look like what's his name, Bolt, who runs for Jamaica. They move at about the rate of a millimeter a day. So they're not very fast. Now, we have fossil records of sponge that are 580 million years old. So they have been around on this earth a very, very long time and are amongst the earliest of multicellular organisms. There are indications they may have been as old as 750 million years, but nobody is sure. And what's 100 million years here or there? Anyway, sponges have been fished for a very long time by human beings because they're useful. And the way in which they were traditionally fished is that young men in particular would put weights, stones, around them, and they would dive into the water holding their breath with a knife. They'd go down as long as they could. They'd cut some off. They had a little net bag. They'd put them in, hold the breath, pop back up, etc. However, the invention of modern technology has put sponge on the endangered list because now they've been nearly fished to extinction. About the end of the 18th century, the first diving diving engine was created. It was basically just a sealed barrel that people could go down and didn't work very well, drowned a lot of people. But this thing, the first diving suit, was patented about 1880 or 1890. And this was used, you can see him with his little hatchet there, and people were up on, there's a pipe going to his helmet, people were up on the boat with an air pump going like that back and forth and pumping air down to him. So a group of sponge divers, we're talking now about the year 1900, a group of sponge divers from some islands up here called Simi and Kalymnos, if ever any of you have ever been to the Dodecanese Islands, just off the Turkish coast, were fishing way down here off the coast of Tunisia, and they were coming back along this way, and they ran into a storm in the Mediterranean, and they pulled into this tiny little island here. There is the Peloponnese. There's my favorite place in Greece where they make the world's best olives, Kalamata. This island is called Kythera, this island is called Antikythera, and there is the island of Crete. So just to give you an idea of the central Mediterranean here. There was a storm, they pulled into the harbor here and they stayed for 3 or 4 days to ride out the storm. But when the storm ended, they thought, well, let's go down and see. Maybe there's a few sponges down here. We'll go down. So they sent a guy down. He popped right back up, and he said, the floor is littered with corpses of horses and men. And nobody believed him, so the captain took the uniform, the suit off, and put that on himself. And he went down, and there were corpses, except they weren't of humans and horses. They were statues. and there were lots and lots of statues and all sorts of things. This was the first maritime wreck found on the floor of the Mediterranean ever. Since that time, there have been more than 1,000 shipwrecks found. That's only a small fraction of what's off the coast here, but nonetheless, it's a significant number. And about 1,000, all older than, say, 1500 of CE. Now, these statues were horses, men, and some other things. They were in bronze and they were in marble. The diving suits they had did not work terribly well. They could stay down for a while, and of course they allowed people to go into deeper water and stay down longer, but they did have problems that were discovered, and these problems had to do with the fact that if you're at the bottom of a deep sea, the water pressure on top of you is very high, and so the air pressure is also high that gets pumped down, and it's enough to get air bubbles that normally don't get expelled in our exhalations, that these air bubbles would get transmitted into the blood and would stay there, and if you popped right back up, it didn't have time to equilibrate or get out, and so these bubbles would be in your blood, and they would tend to locate themselves at the joints where you have bends in your arms or knees or elbows or knees or whatever, and so and they're apparently excruciatingly painful, and this was called the bends because of where they occurred. Now, if these bubbles got to your heart or to your brain, you died, and it was estimated that in about the 2 decades following the invention of this suit, some 10,000 divers died from the bends. That's a very large number. But people discovered after a while that what they first did was just not stay down very long, but then they discovered what has been well known for a long time, that is, if people came up very slowly, that the air had time, these bubbles had time to equilibrate and get out of your body. So you could go down quickly, but you had to come up very slowly, and that slowed down the work process, and that's, of course, not good. The find, which was so spectacular, there were so many pieces, all of which are in museums. This is about 1900, as I said, and the find was reported to the Greek authorities, and they sent an expedition out to recover what they would. The fact that there was bronze found was very significant because, of course, nobody could tell right away how old this thing was, but bronze was not really used for statues after about 2,000 years ago, and that meant that these things were really quite old. Bronze is a funny metal. It doesn't corrode the way, say, iron or other metals would do in the seawater. Bronze is an alloy of copper and tin, and as such, the copper will combine with the salt in salt water and sodium chloride, and it will make copper chloride, a small lesson in chemistry here, I'm sorry, and the tin would form tin oxide, and then marine bacteria would interact with sulfate ions in the seawater and make copper sulfate, and that would protect the surface of the bronze. And so bronze doesn't dissolve in seawater. What does happen if you're not careful, and it took a while to discover, if you bring bronze up from the sea bottom, then the copper sulfate interacts with the oxygen in the air to make sulfuric acid, and that's not good for any metal, including bronze. And this ate away some of this incredible find. Now, aside from the statues and things that they found, they found these little pieces. I've got my slides a little bit out of order, but that's okay. They found these little pieces of bronze, and they had limestone and so forth on them. And you can see that on this one, there is a wheel Okay? The biggest piece here is about the size of a page of a book. So this is not big stuff. So, I mean, there's all this little junk. Who knew what any of this stuff was and what possible importance could it be compared to some of the incredibly beautiful statues that were found. But on this wheel, and over here where you can see the edges of some wheel, and you can perhaps see some writing on there, and there's more wheels over here, there were gear teeth. And this was quite surprising because this thing was old. The first gear teeth we ever saw were from the era around 1000 CE, so not 1,000 years before. So this thing was clearly about 2,000 years old, but 1,000 years before we had any similar sort of gearing mechanism. So that itself was quite remarkable. Although this appeared to be a clockwork of some kind with all these gears, that was clearly impossible because Europe had no mechanical clocks until the 13th century. And mechanical calculators, which this might have been, which also had gears in, didn't appear until the 17th century. There were, however, a few tiny scraps of wood associated, stuck onto these things, and that gave us the idea, or gave those people the idea, that perhaps this had been a mechanism put together in a small wooden box. In Greek literature, there are a few references to wheels that rolled on one on the other. Perhaps that means gear wheels. And there are two famous engineers in Greek antiquity. One is Ctesibius, and the other, of course, is the famous Archimedes. And the Archimedes, who made a lot of machines, and I'll talk about him at the end, some of these machines, which could magnify power, probably did use gears, but we don't have any of these things. But Ctesibius is credited with inventing at least a rack and pinion gear to make a float for a water clock, and that's a gear that rolls on this thing, and this can move. As this rolls, this moves back and forth. There was writing on one of the gear wheels, and that writing was the Greek word moirognomonium. That's a very long word for graduated scale. Some of my Greek colleagues with whom I've worked from the University of Athens said, oh gosh, when I was back studying Euclidean geometry, and that's probably for Greeks, they probably have to do that at 5 years old. When he was studying, they were given a protractor, which is, you know, young people won't know it, we know it was called the moirognomonium. That's a very hard word for an English speaker. And this was used on astrolabes, but astrolabes, which we think were invented about 130 BCE by Hipparchus. And for those of you who can remember way back to when you studied some maths at school, he is the inventor of trigonometry, one of my favorite subjects at least. But we have no real description of an astrolabe until about 600 CE, and we don't have any examples until about 900. For those of you who struggled through Aristotle with me during the week, you might remember that Abelard and Heloise had a child, a young son, whose name was Astrolabe. So it became clear after looking at it that this device was not an astrolabe, it was not a clock, it was not a navigational aid, it was something much different and much older. All of this happened in the first decade of the 20th century, but that was followed by two world wars and the Nazi occupation of Greece, the Greeks cleverly took almost all the goodies out of these wonderful treasures from their museums, and they buried them around in the country in secret locations. Fortunately, they kept track of where they had put them, and mostly. And then, of course, Greece suffered through a terrible civil war following the end of the Second World War. And so it took a long time before the museums put these things back on display, not until about 1964 were they really back. But the Antikythera stuff, all of these little pieces, were left in a box somewhere because who cared? Now, in the early 1950s, Jacques Cousteau and his friends invented scuba diving gear, which people use these days, and they were out running around the Mediterranean, and they went to this site in 1953, and they did a little excavation, and they found that there was a wooden ship buried in the sand about a half a meter below the surface. Ah, wood. Now, wood is made of an organic material. It's carbon, and finding things with carbon in it allows you to date stuff much more accurately. And so this was done, and it was found that the wood was elm, and elm is most commonly grown in central Italy at the time, and so this ship was almost certainly Roman that sunk there. During the 10 years, the next 10 years, the Greeks sent permission to take a small scrap of wood to do carbon dating. If you don't know what carbon dating is, I'll just try to explain it very quickly. We're made of carbon. All organic things are made of carbon. As long as an organic thing is alive, it is ingesting carbon and making new carbon cells and so forth. And carbon comes in primarily an element which has six protons, that defines it as carbon, and it has six neutrons and, of course, six electrons. However, there are isotopes, which are the same numbers of protons and electrons, but slightly different numbers of neutrons. And one, there's an isotope which has seven neutrons, and it's called carbon-13. And it's radioactive, which means that you and I are radioactive. And we are. There's a lot of radioactive elements in us all the time. And we're bombarded by radiation from space that we can do nothing about. So clearly we have evolved over the last several tens and hundreds of thousands of years that we can exist with this stuff. It doesn't kill us. So carbon dating was pretty rare in the 50s or 60s. And the biggest expert of this was a young woman named Elizabeth Ralph, who was at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, USA, my alma mater. And it was shipped there while I was a student, and I used to work with Elizabeth, a very interesting woman. And she when an object stops existing, that is, again, if you struggled through Aristotle, when its substance ends and all that's left is its accidents, it's no longer ingesting and adding carbon, and so it's got a fixed number of carbon-13 atoms in it, and that's it. But carbon-13 being radioactive, we know what the percentage is at a brand new time, and so if we can measure the percentage at any other time, we can tell how long it has been decaying. Its half-life is about 5,000 years. So any object which is between, say, 500 and 10,000 years can easily be dated by measuring how much carbon-13 is in it. And Elizabeth was able to do this, and she showed that the time when the tree was cut down and its substance ended was somewhere between 260 and 180 BCE. So this Roman ship, built perhaps after that time out of this wood, was sailing around at the time when Rome was still a republic but was conquering most of the Mediterranean basin area. Now, besides these bronze fragments, there were other, and statues, there was a lot of other stuff found. There were glass vases and there were amphoras, these big clay jet vessels in which they carried oil and olive oil and wine and all sorts of things. And one of the interesting things is that when you when you look at these things, each city, Athens, Sparta, Thebes, Corinth, Pergamon, Ephesus, all of these individual cities had different forms of amphoras. So by looking at the shapes of the handles and the shapes of the amphoras, you could tell where it came from. And so what they found is that this ship had sailed from the city of Pergamon. It had stopped at Ephesus. It had stopped at Rhodes. And it was presumably on its way back to Rome when it struck the rocks, obviously in a storm, and sank. The Roman general Sulla had sacked Athens in 86 BCE, and he devastated the city, but he left some Roman traces of things, and they looked very similar from 86 BCE to what was found on this ship. But it was the size and the shape of these things that allowed us to get a reasonable date, somewhere between, first of all, it had been originally said that this thing, just from the bronze, had to be between 200 BCE and 200 CE, somewhere in that 400-year period. Now we knew it had to occur roughly around the time 80 to 100 BCE. Cousteau and his crew returned to the site in 1976, and they did some further investigation, and they found coins. Coins are the treasure trove for archaeologists because they're specific to an era and specific to an emperor or king or tyrant or whomever is controlling the city, and therefore they can establish dates really precisely. So we know now that this ship sank somewhere in the period, in a decade between 70 and 80 BCE. That's, I think, right. It may be 60 to 70. I don't know. I can't find it. Anyway, it's within a decade. 2,000 years ago, we can place something to within 10 years. Boy, what an incredible science archaeology really is. Now, by this time, 60 to 70 BC, Sulla was dead, but the general Pompey, who's very famous in Roman history, was busy now devastating Asia Minor, conquering most of that territory for the Romans just before it became an empire. And he had three, in those days a returning general would get some great parade or procession. He had three of these because he was such a successful general or killer of other people or whatever. And it's very likely that this ship was carrying goodies back to be shown off at one of his parades. Now, this device is used for measurements of time, as we shall see. And so we're going to need to talk about time. And to talk about time, we're going to need to talk about calendars. And to talk about calendars, we're going to need to talk about numbers. And I don't apologize because I love numbers, but not everybody loves numbers. And so you will find there's going to be one heck of a lot of numbers coming in about the next 20 minutes. And I can't do any. That's how the world is. Now, if you drive at night back from here into Cape Town, you come over the hill by Hospital Bend, and there's this incredible view of lights over the city of Cape Town. And the wonder, the greatest invention of the 20th century is without doubt the electric light. And it has changed our world. Electricity has changed our world. It is a gift to us from physics, by the way, and I will take part credit for that. It was just Michael Faraday 200 years ago who was messing around in a basement in London with a magnet and a coil of wire, and he discovered electricity. It's a remarkable thing. Fundamental research pays off in the end. That's my lesson for today. In the days before the electric light, all the light that there was at night came from up there. We could see the stars, and the stars were our television sets of ancient times. People lay out and looked at the stars all the time, and they knew one heck of a lot more than you and I know about the heavens. We know, for example, that today is the 25th of January. It's a Saturday, and that it's midsummer here. It's cold as hell in the Northern Hemisphere. And we know that the weather is gradually going to change, and we know roughly when the, what is it called, vernissage? No. Vendange, when they collect the grapes, will happen. What is it called? The harvest. Well, when we harvest things. There's some nice French word for that, I can't remember. And we know when to plant, we know when to harvest, we know that people like to get married in June, and all this sort of stuff. But this hasn't always been true. In ancient times, to tell the day, people made crazy things like boards with holes in it. They'd move a peg from day to day. You know, today would be red day, and then it would be yellow day, and then it would be orange day. And they could keep rough track of things. And this is a problem. Okay, especially as civilization grew, but the only way we had to tell time was by either the sun or the stars. And so that's what we did. Now, if we erect a stick in the ground, and we look at its shadow, this stick is called a gnomon, the G is not pronounced, the gnomon, in Greek for the word for indicator, and here's the sun shining down, and there's the shadow is here of the stick, and there's the end of the shadow at different times. When the shadow is longest, we call that winter. That here is the 21st of June. And when it is shortest, we call that, summer. And that's the 21st of December, opposite in the Northern Hemisphere. The length and direction of the shadow varies slowly over the course of a given day, and it points in roughly opposite directions at sunrise and at sunset. When the shadow is shortest, it points north in the Northern Hemisphere, south in the Southern Hemisphere, and that time when it is shortest is our definition of noon. The solar day, which is defined as noon to noon and is 24 hours long, is different from another day. If we look at a given star and we stare at it, and then we wait until the vault of the heavens goes around and that star occurs at the same point, that's called a stellar day, or sidereal to use the proper term, and that's 23 hours and 56 minutes long, approximately, a mere four minute difference. You and I would have no conception of that at all. People in the Ur of Chaldees in 5,000 years ago knew the difference between those two numbers. I don't know. Maybe if you just lie looking at the stars for years on end. Now, at noon, the length of the shadow changes, the position of the shadow and the length of it changes from day to day. And if I go out every day and I wait for noon and I mark the position on the ground over 365 days, this is what I find. This is called an analemma, in the Greek, nice Greek word. And there is the longest possible shadow. This is obviously from the Northern Hemisphere, because there's January, there's December, and there is the shortest shadow, or the summer solstice, and in between we have the equinoxes, the time when we have 12 hours of daylight and 12 hours of nighttime. Here this is autumn and this is spring, and this is the shape that one gets. So we have two definitions of the day, and we had rough definitions of a week and a month, but what's really hard are longer periods of time, namely the year. How do we know the year from this point, say, 21st of March to 21st of March? That's very hard. Now, the Babylonians made a rough guess at that, and they said 360 days. And they liked that number because the Babylonians had a very different counting system than we do. That's our counting system. It's a base 10. We start over again, 11, etc., 21, 31. The Babylonians counted to 60. It's called a sexagesimal system, and it's better than a base 10 system because a base 10 system can only be divided by 2 and 5 into parts, whereas or 1, of course, but that's irrelevant, whereas a sexagesimal system can be divided by 2, by 4, by 8, by 6, etc. Lots of things. However, we don't use that anymore, but we have a lot of vestiges still of that because we still have 60 seconds in a minute, 60 minutes in an hour, 360 degrees in a circle. That's 5,000-year-old remnant of Babylonian astronomy. Now, 360 days is wrong, of course. And what would happen is the calendar would get out of track with the seasons, and so the Egyptians, to make it better, added 5 days to make 365 days in the year, and that's pretty good, but it's not right. And so, after 40 years, which is within the lifespan of people, the calendar would be 10 days out of sync with the seasons, and that wasn't so great. So in 46 BCE, just before he was murdered, Julius Caesar changed it, and he added the leap year and created what is called the Julian calendar, so that every 4 years we added one day, we had 366 days, and that made the year 365 and a quarter days long. And that calendar lasted for 1,500 years, but it's wrong. And it's wrong because that year is too long, not too short, too long by 11 minutes and 14 seconds. Not something that we would notice in a year, but boy, in 1,500 years, it was quite noticeable, so that the vernal equinox in Rome, and the vernal equinox is crucial to the church for setting the date of Easter, which depends on this day. But by 1500, this was not the 21st of March. It had moved down here to the 11th of March. It was off by 10 days. And so the church quickly realized that if they didn't do something, that after a while Easter and Christmas would occur at the same time. And that was not acceptable. So after centuries of arguing, the church does not move quickly. After centuries of arguing about it, finally in 1582, Pope Gregory the 13th ordered a revision of the calendar, and they changed it by a teeny tiny amount, because the century date, 1600, 1700, etc., were leap years. So he said, well, we'll only have that happen once every 400 years. So 1600 will be a leap year, but not 1700, 1800, 1900. And if you remember, 2000 was a leap year, and there won't be another leap year like that until 2400. So the year was now 300, this is the formula, 365 plus one quarter minus one one hundredth to take out the centuries, but plus one 400th to put one back every four centuries. And that gives 365.2425 days to the year, and that's pretty good. And so we're living with that. Now, this was 1582, and it was some 40 or 50 years after Martin Luther had created the Reformation and created Protestantism. And so this was a revision ordered by a Catholic pope, that many of the Protestants would have nothing to do with it. And so they stayed on the Julian calendar. The British waited some 200 years before changing, by which time it was not 10 days, but 11 or 12 days. And there were all kinds of myths associated with that that aren't true, like there were riots as people wanted their 11 days back, but none of that is, it's a great story, but it's apparently not true. And there are still countries, I think Saudi Arabia, which does not use the Gregorian calendar, as it is called. So, this is the situation in the world. We knew from the Greeks that the Earth was a sphere, and we even knew how big it was, which I will get to. But we were trying to create models of the world. We knew that we had a heavens or the earth which rotated once every 24 hours. And we could then create a models of the universe, of our world, sort of like this. Here is the so-called celestial sphere. Here is the track of the sun, who's the earth, obviously, at the center of the universe. Here is the Earth, the Sun rather, traveling around us in a plane that is called the ecliptic. It's actually the plane in which the Earth and the planets move, and the Sun sits over here. And the Sun moves from here to here, back and forth over the year in our sky. Here we are at 34 and a half degrees down here, and 2 hours off, so we're about here. This in the northern hemisphere is summer, there's winter, and here are the equinoxes when we cross the celestial equator. I have another picture of this. This is from an Earth-based system. Here we are standing. Here is the sun. There it is, its path at spring and autumn, and here is the Tropic of Cancer, if you will, and there is the Tropic of Capricorn. So we had some order in the skies above us, and now I can never resist coming back to talk about my favorite people, Plato and Aristotle. Plato considered not particularly the real world, but he considered the ideal world. He looked for perfection. He looked for ideals. He did not care really how the world itself, which is all this dirt and rubbish that underneath us, how that worked. And so the motions of the heavens for him had to be in that most perfect of shapes, the sphere. Okay, and that's where we get all of these ideas about circles and sphere come originally actually from Pythagoras, but from Pythagoras as adapted by Plato. Excuse me. Now, the Earth, we go back one. The Earth sits in the middle, and there's no down from the middle, so the Earth can't fall, because there's no place to go. It's already at the center, there's no down. So that was not a problem. And everything you see was spherical around us. The planets move on. I have to come to Aristotle, who's much more interested in actually how the world works. He too believes that the sphere is perfect. And in fact, the most perfect sphere is the sphere that goes the fastest. And that's, of course, the sphere of the stars. Now, for the Greeks, and up until the time of Copernicus, the stars were close. The universe was small. It was not this incredibly vast, unbelievably vast universe that we have. The stars were fairly close, but the stars were farthest away, and they would go rotate around once every 24 hours, and that was the most perfect sphere that there was. For Plato, he said, Empedocles had already decided that the universe was made of five elements. There were the normal ones, earth, air, fire, and water. And there was a fifth element, which I'll get to. But Plato associated these with the five Platonic solids. These are the only solid objects that can be made out of plane figures. So There's a tetrahedron made out of equilateral triangles, the cube made out of squares, the octahedron made out of equilateral triangles, the icosahedron the same, and there's the dodecahedron, the 12-sided figure made out of pentagons. And this is the fifth element. It's called fifth element, quintessence, fifth element, and it's perfect. It's the ether. It's the stuff that the heavens are made of. In fact, everything from the moon out is composed of this perfect stuff. And the heavens, the perfect stuff, can move in circles because that's perfect. However, these terrestrial things can only move in straight lines, earth and water down, air and fire up, only in straight lines. And Aristotle's argument against the rotation of the earth, which was around in Greek times, was that if the earth was rotating, it would have to go in a circle, and only these perfect things can move in circles. I like this kind of reasoning. It's completely wrong, but it's very logical. It just shows you how bad reason is. Only perfect things can go in circles, and so this is made of this stuff. It can only go in straight lines. So it can't be rotating like that. Now, the stars are, since the stars are bright, the sun is hot, etc., but they're all perfect, and so they all ride on these crystal spheres, because we can see through them, and it's the friction, the rubbing against these spheres that causes them to shine and be bright. Another completely crazy idea. Now, Aristotle did know that the earth was round. Okay? Anybody who tells you that people believed the earth was flat before Columbus and you'd sail off the edge, that's a story to tell to three-year-olds, and after three-year-olds you should never believe it. He knew the earth was round, and he knew it in two ways. He knew it first because he could see the shadow of the earth on the moon during eclipses, and it's round. Okay? That means he also understood that an eclipse was due to the earth blocking the light from the sun. But also he lived in a maritime culture as we do here, and he could watch ships sail away from him, and he would notice that the hull of the ship would disappear before the top of the mast as it went around the bend. And that only takes about 10 or 15 kilometers before the hull will disappear and only the top of the ship stays visible. Also, he had information from the Egyptians that if you went far up the Nile, that is a lot farther south, where things were in the heavens changed their position, and that would be expected if you're moving around the round stuff. So he knew it was round. And even though Aristotle... Oh, I'm not doing too bad. Even though Aristotle and Plato dominated Greek philosophy, they were not the only ones. There was certainly Demosthenes, who taught us that the world was made of atoms, another thing that Aristotle denied, and Heraclitus, who said, no, the earth really does rotate around its axis once a day. Now, I'll just do two things, and then we'll have our break. Alexander the Great was the son of King Philip of Macedon and a student of Aristotle's. So obviously, as a very wealthy man, Philip could command or hire the best teacher in the country for his son. Plus ça change, as the French would say. He conquered the world, everything that was known at the time, and then some. However, he died very early. He died at 323 BCE. He was only 33 years old, and his empire was divided up amongst his generals, and in particular, his general Ptolemy Soter took Egypt. And the name Ptolemy was used for centuries after by the Greek population of Egypt. And there's a very famous one we will come to. What he's most famous for is he founded the Museum of Alexandria, which had that famous library in it. But for us, the most... Now, a museum is a place that's dedicated to the muses. These are the nine Greek goddesses of epic poetry and lyric poetry and music and astronomy and history and all these nine subjects. The goddess of astronomy, the muse of astronomy, is named Urania, which is where we get the name Uranium and the planet Uranus from, and so forth. There was another, I'll talk about what they did. This was the first site of mathematical and observational learning in the ancient world, this library. But far from there, on the island of Samos in the Mediterranean, there was a very famous philosopher named Aristarchus, who was born shortly after Aristotle died, just a year after Alexander. And he was the first person to put the sun at the center of the universe, and nobody paid any attention to him. But what he did do is he calculated the distance from the Earth to the Moon, and he got it pretty right. But he had a yardstick, and his yardstick was the diameter of the Earth, which he didn't know. But he said it was somewhere between 35 and 40 Earth diameters, and it's somewhere between 30 and 35 Earth diameters. And as your homework problem for today, go out and calculate how far the moon is without looking it up in Google. It's not an easy thing to do. Later, after he was dead, Eratosthenes, another Greek who lived from 276 to 195, did measure the diameter of the Earth. Eratosthenes was born in Alexandria, Egypt, and he was a surveyor. Now, surveyors were of great importance because there was not a lot of arable land in Egypt. There's an awful lot of desert. The arable land was primarily along the Nile, of course. If a farmer died and his sons, daughters didn't count, unfortunately, if his sons inherited the land, it had to be equally divided, and so surveyors were important to guarantee that each plot was equal, otherwise sons would kill each other. And he was told that at the solstice, that is at the 21st of June in the Northern Hemisphere, that in the city of Cyrene, which was up about 700 miles south of Alexandria along the Nile, that the sun was straight overhead. And they could tell that because they could see the reflection at the bottom of a well. And however, he said, "No, look, in Alexandria on that day, the sun isn't straight up. It's 7 degrees at noon." Now, he said, if the sun is far away, and it is far away, you know, the Earth's radius is some 5,000 miles, the sun is 100 million miles away, so it's much farther away. If that's true, then this 7-degree angle is not only true at the surface, but it must be pretty true at the center. So between Cyrene and Alexandria is a 7-degree pie slice of the Earth. Now, the Greeks, and boy, these guys really knew their geometry. The Greeks would say that if you know the angle of a pie slice and you know the radius of the pie, then you can calculate the circumference arc. Or if you know the angle, 7 degrees, and you know the length of the arc, you can calculate the radius. 700 miles, if I can figure that out, I can tell how big the Earth is. So he hired some guy to walk 700 miles. And he had some kind of mechanical counter and calculated his steps, and they calculated the radius of the Earth, and they got an answer within 5%. So problem two is go out and figure out the size of the Earth. These guys were astounding what they knew. Aristarchus had tried to measure, had tried to say that there could be a heliocentric system was the way the universe was made, and that was ignored. And because Alexandria was measuring the positions, people gave up trying to figure out a physical system for the universe. They went back to Aristotle's idea of the Earth at the middle and all these crystal spheres, and they said, well, that's not very accurate, but it you know, the hell with that. What we want to know is where the planets and the sun will be at a given time, and the moon, so we can tell astrological forecasts, we can time religious festivals, and we can know when eclipses will take place. And that's all that matters. And I'll go a little bit, one more thing. And so what the people at Alexandria did is they made a table, and they had instruments, including the astrolabe. There is an astrolabe. It's a complicated thing. This is a Moirognomonian graduated scale. And they had a three-dimensional version of it called the armillary sphere, which is the world's first GPS system. And so... And they also had, you know, measuring rods. What they obviously did not have were telescopes. So I'm going to stop there. Let's meet again somewhere between 10 past and 10:15, and we'll start again.